Barry Lopez is a writer of fiction and nonfiction, both in long form and in short, in essays and in short stories. He calls himself a freelance writer. His readers say he has opened doors to landscape, to mind, and to spirit they might never otherwise have seen. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. My guest today on this conversation is Barry Lopez. Barry, welcome and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Our pleasure. I said just a moment ago that one of the things I want to do at the outset is to help us define terms so those who have not read your works and those who have can get a sense of your thinking.
Yes.
This first is about landscape. You have written that landscape in its many forms was the first protagonist in the human story.
Yes.
What does that mean to you, protagonist?
I guess in the protagonist is the one that cocks the gun, I guess, or something like that. I think probably I'm trapped like everyone else in my culture, in Western culture, behind these terms. Landscape is a term that means more to me than it, I think, does to most people in Western societies. Landscape to me is not scenery. It's a kind of animation. When I say landscape, I mean not just line and space and color, but movement, the movement of weather through a place, the history of water in a place, which is revealed in the short term by a rainstorm or water going down the Chena or something like that, but is revealed in the long term when you see forms of erosion and you say, oh, water's been around here for a while doing things, and then the more closely you look, the deeper you get into the history of the place. So when I think of landscape, I think of a tremendously expanded. I think of that word meaning much more than it means when we talk about landscape painting. The difficulty with the term is that for people like us, we made a very deliberate movement in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley when we decided we would step outside of nature and create what was later called an agricultural revolution and the raising of cities like Ur. And later there was an industrial revolution that moved us even farther from nature. And this term landscape for us means that out there, not us, that thing that's separated from us. And when some 15 or 20 years ago, when I first started, I guess, apprenticing myself to other cultures, to Inupiat culture here and to Inuit culture in northern Canada, and later people in Australia and in Africa, what I began to see was that for most traditional peoples, this separation never took place, that they don't have a word like landscape because they don't separate themselves out the way we do. So I guess the way I use that word, and probably the greatest effort I made to define what I mean by that word is in a book called Arctic Dreams, where what I was trying to deal with was, if we accept this idea that we're outside of nature, and we say there is that out there and then there's us, a way to understand this is that for our culture, we're like someone who got off the stage and said, okay, I'll be the director. And for most traditional cultures, what they've said is, you're not the director, we are all the actors. And what they're saying sometimes to us is, please get back on the stage, please step back into the surround that we call nature, and stop calling it landscape and see yourself as a part of it. And what I was trying to do in Arctic Dreams is to say, well, instead of saying who's right and who's wrong, I want to think about this. How does the most human attribute, which is imagination, how does that come into play with landscape? How do we imagine a place like the Arctic? How does a scientist imagine a place like this? How does someone who lives here from the time of conception believe, respond to this place? And how do politicians look at it? Or, you know, not to disparage politicians, but to use them as an example of a class of people whose life in some ways turns around manipulation of people's emotions and tax monies and things like that. And then how is it seen historically? How do we imagine the Arctic was discovered? So I wanted to look at the way we imagine a place And the kinds of imagination I was interested in was the scientific imagination, the literary imagination, which is what my mind is about. When I look at icebergs, I'm thinking about cathedral architecture as much as I'm thinking about the crystalline structure inside that iceberg, and look at the place through this historical imagination. But I also wanted to know what's coming back. Mm. How does landscape shape imagination? How is the run of a language tempered by a particular place? Why is it that it's not just accent, but a kind of behavior that leads you and I to believe that person, that's a Southern way of doing things, or that's a Texas way of doing things, or that's a Minnesota way of doing things. And we're confident when we say that we're close to the truth. What is it about those places that have shaped people in such a way that it's discernible? So when I say landscape, what I'm talking about is the horror and the brilliance and the intimidation and the ecstasy, all of which is a part of our interaction with the places where we live. And I'm curious, I guess, as I grow older as a writer, about how we can get back inside. Because in our culture, the pain that's most apparent to me, and I say this because I would say as a writer, I write out of a love of my people, my sense of what my responsibilities are as a writer are to help, to tell us to write a short story or an essay or a book, and a person can walk away from it and say, I feel better. It's not Pollyanna, not saying, oh, well, the world is going to be, tomorrow is all going to be glory, we're all going to heaven or something, you know, but you can come away from a story and say, I feel a greater sense of my worth, I feel more dignified, I feel life is more possible. That's what I want somehow to come out of a story. And to do that, I want to find out how can we understand a way to live where we can incorporate everything that is in we see in the natural world, wolves killing caribou, puppies, you know, wolf puppies, you know, the way the heart goes out to that little fuzzy face, you know, that feeling. How can we incorporate that into our lives so that we live fuller and more richly with more grace? So landscape is, I guess, attracted me because when I was growing up as a boy, that's where the shapes were for me. I didn't grow up in a city. I grew up in a kind of rural landscape in Southern California and in the Mojave Desert. And that stuff got inside me. And those images and those smells and feelings and the wonder of being in those places just bloomed in me. And I thought, I would love to know how to make this happen in another human being. Do you want a shorter answer?
Yeah. Trim that, please.
Okay.
This is Barry Lopez on Conversations. We stepped off the stage. We removed ourselves from the landscape.
Yes.
As you were talking, I was wondering how we stand relative to it as a culture. Is our back to it? Are we looking over our shoulder? Do we reach back out to it? I sense a yearning in our culture for the landscape we have
yes.
stepped away from, but an inability to get to it. Very few of us live close to, within, on the land, see it as brother, sister, mother.
I think that there are many people who live in close association with landscapes who aren't really there. As there are people who live, say, maybe in downtown Fairbanks, who are more closely connected to the landscape than somebody who's living out in a village.
And not to muddle the situation, but downtown Fairbanks is also a landscape.
New York
yes.
City.
No,
absolutely.
Yes.
But it's a created landscape, which means that I think the greater, the more your local landscape is a human creation, the greater risk you run of becoming the victim of your own misconceptions. Mm. In other words, if you and I are given a stage and we erect a set and create a set of truths on that stage, it's all going to work as long as we started off with the truth. But if we were wrong to begin with, then that error is perpetuated through the whole design. And that's the problem with human creation. There let me see how to, in Europe and in Africa and in Asia, many American writers, much of current American literature is seen as a solipsistic literature, a literature that is entirely self-referential, that has nothing to do with the outside world, but turns continuously within itself. Mm-hmm. And so as a reader, you come to a book like that and you say, well, what's in here for me? How can I get in here? And that kind of literature has also created, unfortunately, a group of writers whom, to my way of thinking, don't help society. The stories they're interested in telling are stories that are really about themselves, and they are of limited value to most people. If we do, as you say, have a yearning for nature, I think it's a yearning for something outside of ourselves because we're so lonely. Every situation I have been in, all over the world, literally, with indigenous people, I've always asked, what do you think of when you think of us? I mean, not of televisions and that kind of thing, but what do you think of us as how do you see us as a culture? And very often the answer is lonely. You're very lonely people. You're isolated from each other, and much of your pain in your conversation has to do with the lack of connection you have to your families or to your lovers or to the things that really make your heart beat fast. And you're always saying, I wonder how I can rearrange my life to have this connection again. Mm-hmm. And over the years, what that came to mean to me was seeing the way my own culture lives, and I'm speaking in the United States now, in which the United States is a country in which people are obsessed with being in power, not with being in love. And that difference causes people to devote themselves to many things that, from my point of view, are destructive, one of which is hierarchical arrangements. This man is better than this woman by virtue of just a difference in gender. Or this white person is better than this black person because just the skin color, that's the only issue, you know. These things they're not just absurd, and they're not just wrong, they're dangerous. They are destructive ideas to me, to have this hierarchical arrangement where one person is better than another person by virtue of skin color or religion or cultural background or gender or something like that. And where we live in a time, fortunately, when these issues are being examined. But these, to me, are not issues that are fashionable. These are issues that go right to the heart of the truth. Once you begin saying, this person is better than this person, without having any knowledge of what the spiritual nature of that person is, this is a profoundly evil thing to me. So when I look at my own culture and I see that so much of what goes on in the United States turns around issues of power, mm-hmm. being an authority, controlling other people, deciding what other people should do, stifling the personality of someone who is not pretty enough for you. You know, you think, if you take a young woman who's 15 years old, who's not beautiful in a conventional way, she's terrorized by television advertising and by magazines into thinking that if she doesn't end up looking like this, that nobody will want her and that she will have no role to play in society of significance. And a 15-year-old child is not equipped mm-hmm. to fight against that. And what I want to know is, where are this woman's friends? Where are the people to gather around her to say, you do not have to get married, have children, go to a university, do this, do that, and the other thing, in order to be of value to society? What we should be saying is, what's going on in there? What are you thinking about? But we don't. What we do is stifle personality.
Tell me, give me just a, it's, and I'm, I guess I'm going to ask you for just a knee-jerk reaction, but are we going further towards this kind of damaging relationship with each other, or are we pulling back? What's your assessment of optimism here?
I don't know. I'm just another person in the street, you know.
Well, you think about these things a lot, though.
Well, I do think about them a lot, but I'm also a victim of like everybody else, you know. When I sit down to write a story, all I can say is what I saw. You know, I went here, I saw this, this is what happened. I can't say, you know, the thing, do you swear in a Bible to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Well, what person can tell the whole truth? Mm. Nobody. You can't tell the whole truth. You can only say what you know. So my feeling is that I'm glad that these issues have been with us since Columbus got here, which are colonial issues of being in power, of imposing our wills, the group in power imposing its will on all those who are not in power. This has been around for a long time. I'm glad that it's being examined in the environment that the political environment we've got now with Clinton as a president. That means that some of these issues at least can surface and can be spoken of. They can be treated in public conferences without people being afraid that they're going to be shot. Although actually today, I think a fear is still with you. If you raise certain issues, you will be shot. But I'd like to be optimistic about this, but I'm not. I'm hopeful. Mm-hmm. I think there's a difference between being hopeful and being optimistic. And I'm not optimistic because we have a legacy now. You said this earlier, and I agree with you. You hate to say, well, all of this is because of the Reagan-Bush years. But we spent 12 years in which it was better to be wealthy. People were more interested in being wealthy than being intelligent. It was all right to be ignorant if you had money, and that meant ignorance meant prejudice and all of these mm-hmm. other things, and taking advantage of other people. And again, to go back to what I said earlier, we are a country that is more or less obsessed with being in power, with arranging things in hierarchies, telling people what to do, and whether or not it's benevolent is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. What we should be thinking about is how can we be in love? And I don't mean that in an adolescent way. What I mean is, how can you, what is the, because, well, let me see how to say this. So many of the human relationships that I bump into, as all of us bump into, what we see is that the people are not, their discussions and their feelings are not turning around issues of love of each other. They're turning around issues of power. Who's in power? Who has the authority to say how something is going to be handled? And the relationship between society and landscape, you know, to go back to the way I tried to describe this, that we have a colonial relationship with landscape. We have feelings of warmth toward land, but basically we want land to do something, to earn its keep. It had better be beautiful, it had better produce natural resources, it had better be full of lovely caribou running across the horizon or something. It's got to do something for us. We don't have the sense that we should, that there is a, that we should establish a reciprocal relationship that is built on respect and mutual admiration and a sense of mystery and of vulnerability and of giving in, all the things that distinguish a loving relationship. Mm-hmm. And that loving relationship, rather than an authoritarian or a power relationship with land, is one that would help us enormously.
This is the fundamental shift you talk about when you're talking about responding to environmental problems. We can't just throw money at it.
Oh, no.
We have to completely switch
What we're talking, if I go back to my years in college, the social movement that galvanized my generation of people was the civil rights movement, and for many people like myself who were, I think the gift of that time, in spite of all of the people who were killed, and who were scarred for life, the great gift of that time was that a group of black people awakened a group of white people to issues of fundamental justice and helped a group of white people who, for no other reason than because they were white, were in power. And when that group of young white people listened to what black people were saying, they woke up mm-hmm. somehow, and they said, there's an issue of justice here that is deeply and profoundly wrong, and something must be done. And then out of that movement came the so-called environmental movement, and also to some extent, I think, the women's movement. And what all of those movements have in common is they are fundamentally movements, to my way of thinking, about justice, about the establishment of just relationships in society. And in addition, they are, to me, reactions against hierarchy. What what all of these people were talking about was the kind of death that comes when you say one thing is better than another, instead of how can we devise a just way of living for all people, so that if wisdom is truly what's going to guide us, that we will not lose a pocket of wisdom because we say, oh, well, this person has the wrong accent, or this person has the wrong gender, or this person is a Baptist, or something, you know, as superficial as all of those things. Mm-hmm. Part of the privilege, I think, of my own life is that I get to see a lot. I travel all over the world, and I talk to lots of different kinds of people. And I tell you, at the age of 48, I am still taught every day that the most profound observation that comes out of a lifetime of paying attention to the world can come from the person that you least think is capable of making a statement like that. And so that teaches me and reminds me every day, listen to everyone. Don't ever close a door because you say, oh, well, that's not my politics, or that's not my type of person, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, and somebody asked me the other day about so-called nature writing. You know, people like myself and Annie Dillard or Peter Matheson, we're all sort of stuffed into this box of being nature writers. And I don't like that term. And it's not just the natural reaction of writers who don't like to be called one thing or another. Whatever term they want to use, I guess, is all right with me in the end, because that's not, you know, I just go on working anyway. But what I think I'm involved in and have been for 25 years as a writer are issues of justice. And it happens that because I grew up in the environment that I grew up in, and I was exposed to animals and to big landscapes in the West, and that was my childhood experience. Then, what happened when I was 11, my mother remarried and I moved to New York City, and I went to a private prep school, and I got a very good education. And the way those two things came together for me was that I was schooled enough to be able to understand the history of justice and what a struggle this had been for how many thousands of years, and how often it went wrong. And when of course you're compelled as a writer to want to write about justice and dignity and the possibilities for human life. But I'm not a philosopher. I can't sit down and write a disciplined philosophical essay about that. I just couldn't do that. But I can tell a story. That's all I do, is tell a story. But if I'm really working, if I'm really paying my keep as a human being in the world, then you're not going to be able to read a story by me and not get some sense that, well, this is about polar bears, but what's deeper in here is something else about what is the nature of a dignified relationship with a polar bear or anything else. I think some of the most wonderful letters I get are from people who say, you wrote this about this desert, or when you were traveling to the Galapagos, you wrote this, or I read this piece that you wrote about being at the South Pole, and I don't really want to go to the South Pole, or I don't care about polar bears, or you'll never get me in the tropics, or something like that. But they'll say, the relationships that are set up in this story are exactly those that trouble me at the moment about my life, and this story has helped clarify them. I don't know what more wonderful letter you could get from someone to say, the things that you seem to be interested in on the surface, that's not what I'm interested in. But you're trying to talk about a set of relationships that are interesting to me. I live in a city, I have these other situations that are mine, you know. And by reading what you had to say over here, I understood what I was doing over here, so thank you. And then you feel as a writer, well, good, that you're helping, that you're not, that you've asked for somebody's time to read a story and they read it and it's okay. Something happened that was good for them. Mm-hmm. So.
We're talking today, listening today.
I'm talking a lot.
It's all right. To writer Barry Lopez. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Barry Lopez has 9 books out, if I counted correctly, and one very much in the works that I'm going to ask him about in just a minute. The books are almost consistently award-winning, Of Wolves and Men, which came out in 1978, the next year, took the John Burroughs Society Medal and the Christophers of New York Medal, both in 1979. Arctic Dreams, probably the most praised of his books, the National Book Award in Nonfiction, one of the most coveted awards for writers in the nation, and several others. The books that you may want to look for, Desert Notes, the earliest book, Giving Birth to Thunder, we also know this as Coyote in Alaska. John Adams developed a marvelous piece of music, John Luther Adams, around this work. Once again, Of Wolves and Men, River Notes, Winter Count, Arctic Dreams, Crossing Open Ground, Crow and Weasel, and The Rediscovery of North America. Crow and Weasel was something of a departure, a real move into fiction, and the story of a fable story of two young boys. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. I do want to ask you about this work in progress. You say you have been working on this book for 6 years.
For 6 years, yeah. Well, things always overlap a little bit. I think I'm old enough now to see that I have a pattern.
As a writer.
As a writer, that I seem to work for a while on shorter pieces while I'm building toward a bigger piece. So,
and are the shorter pieces fabric to the larger piece?
In some way they are. I think I must be trying to figure out rhythms of language and narrative voice, and just not in a conscious way, but I'm just working with language, trying to just make my way in the world of language, and then. After a period of time, I want to work on a big landscape. I mean, a large scale, and that's where a book like Of Wolves and Men comes from.
When you're working your way through language, are you working your way through thought?
Sometimes, but I remember saying to someone once, if I ever caught myself thinking, I would know that I wasn't writing.
Hello. Because what?
Because writing is not about thought. If you're thinking when you're writing, then you're trying to make a point, it starts to me in my mind to drift toward propaganda or something like that. Yeah. If I begin a short story, I have no idea where that story is going to go, and I don't want to know where it's going to go. I start with an image, a movement of someone's hand or something like that, and then I just follow.
This is Conversations. We're talking with writer Barry Lopez.
So you said, you know, you're working on this book for 6 years.
Right.
It's not 6 years of every day.
Right.
It's during this six-year period, I finished Crow and Weasel, this illustrated fable. I completed a collection of essays and wrote another long essay that became a book called The Rediscovery of North America.
Right.
I've also finished another collection of stories, which will come out probably before this big book. And I've been traveling, working on essays in remote parts of the world. I look at that in some way as this part of the research for this big book. But there are also things that I'm doing for this big book that have not appeared and won't appear in an essay or in a short story.
Right.
They'll culminate some way in this big book.
Is there a nutshell for the big book? Can you say, in this book, I am wanting to say this?
I think I could. I mean, I'd try with you to get at what it is. I don't talk very much about work that I'm trying to do, not because I think that it's I don't want anybody to know or something like that. It's more I don't want to find out about it. I'd rather be intimidated and frightened by it until I was on the other side of it.
And is that real for you?
Beyond any question. I don't think if you're not terrified, or I say to myself this, you know, if I'm not terrified when I'm working on something, I don't know how good it's going to be. I mean terrified in the sense of the questions that occur to you are, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
How can I possibly be trying to write about issues that are this big? Or, or you know, I say to myself all the time, you're going to write that, you don't know anything. You haven't read this. You don't want to talk to this person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a game. I mean, I'm old enough to know that that's not a game. I want to be in a position of being afraid with work, because that's an edge that I like to work against. I like to be uncertain and frightened of failure, because that's just something that drives me.
I will overcome.
I don't know if I'm that confident about it, because I think if you know you will overcome, then it's a kind of a phony deal. You know, so I don't know that I will. I know what I'm trying to do, and I know that I'm at great risk. I'm not interested in doing something that I did before. I want to do something I haven't done before. And in order to do that, I have to go out into territory, into emotional territory or intellectual territory, sometimes real territory, that I've never been in before, and that's not easy for me.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that part of this book deals with Antarctica, and for reasons that are probably too complicated to get into, I started diving, scuba diving, when I began work on this book. I saw that what I wanted to do was explore this vertical dimension of life, because we're such horizontal creatures. We look out on that horizon, and that's where we track everything. We very rarely look up and very rarely look down. Mm-hmm. And so I began thinking, how can I open up this vertical sense of life? In part because I think once life gets more vertical, it becomes more hopeful.
Translate that.
Let's see.
Why is there hope in height or depth?
For the same reason that you feel different when you're outdoors and in a prison cell. You know, part of being in a prison cell is being crushed from the top and the bottom and from all four sides. If you blow those walls apart, you don't have to have a good meal or a glass of water or anything else. All of a sudden, life looks a lot better. And I think that in this play back and forth between landscape and our spiritual and psychological, emotional interiors, if a person has more space, physical space in which to be, the sense of hope that can come is increased. So I began, and that's why I say it's sort of, somehow it doesn't make sense, but it makes perfect sense to me.
It's a matter of taking the restraints off.
Yes.
Of something.
Of saying, here's more room in which to be yourself, or to look, or to think about things.
Or to image, you know?
I just want to open things up. And as I said, I'm just groping now, trying to find, I don't know sometimes what I'm doing with this. Mm-hmm. But I knew that I wanted to start diving, and I wanted to look at this first 150 feet. So I've been diving and flying this acrobatic kite in the first 150 feet up there. Just what I want to do is you know, I realized this at the South Pole. What I wanted to do at the South Pole was to fly a kite when I got there, because I was disturbed by the notion of all of these flags flying, the flags of the original signatory nations.
Mm.
The Antarctic Treaty is a treaty founded on a sense of equality among all nations, and I was offended by the idea that all of these flags are flying at the South Pole, and I thought, what would my friends do if they got to the South Pole? And most of them would say, they would agree, I would hope, that you could just fly a kite that doesn't belong to any nation or anything, and just fly it above the flags.
Mm-hmm.
So I was flying my kite at the South Pole and thinking about the only animal that lives at the South Pole is the wind. And the only way to really learn about the wind is to get that kite up there and feel it in your body, to feel the wind moving around up there. So I started working in this first 150 feet above the ground and then 150 feet below. And last year, when I went back to Antarctica, I went back with a group of divers whom I've worked with in different places to dive under the ice in Antarctica, in McMurdo Sound. And I...
What's the temperature in McMurdo Sound?
The water or the air?
The water.
The water's 28.6 degrees.
Brr.
28.6.
And what do you wear?
You wear a dry suit and gloves and a hood. And
so you're completely insulated from...
Completely covered. The insulation, you know, after about a half hour in the water, your parts of your body are quite cool.
Okay, go ahead. I just had to wonder about that.
But that was frightening to me, to drop down a shaft through the ice that's 6 feet thick into a world that was magnificent. But there's only one way out of that world, and that's through that hole in the ice above you. And if you can't find that hole, then you can't get out and you die there. And you're working, your equipment is right at the edge of failure all the time anyway, because your body, your breath, for example, produces fresh water, moisture, that will freeze at a temperature at which salt water stays liquid. So that means that ice crystals are beginning to build up in the equipment that you're using to breathe, and you run the risk of having that equipment malfunction. Mm-hmm. So it's a dangerous thing to be doing, and I don't do it because it's dangerous and I think I'm a tough guy or something like that. I do it because it's necessary for me to discover what it is I hunger to learn. And I have to push myself sometimes in order to do those things, because like any person, you become afraid. I mean, I didn't start diving under the ice because I thought it would present no problems to me. I knew that it would be hard for me to do, but I've been in situations where I knew I was going to be at risk for malaria and all these other things, and I don't do them because I have a cavalier attitude about life and I'm willing to throw my life away. But my responsibilities are to learn certain things, and in order to learn them, I have to do these things. So what I try to do is find the best people, I mean grown-ups, people who are not show-offs and trying to impress you with how tough they are, but really mature people who've been in the field a long time and know what they're doing, and then I go with them. And then with their instruction and their help and their comradeship and companionship, things have worked pretty well. But to loop back, you asked about what this big book was about. If I look backward and say, well, Arctic Dreams was about the relationship between imagination and landscape, I think what I'm trying to look at now is, what is the relationship between emotion and landscape? And the emotion that I'm most interested in is hope. So the question that's in front of me with this book is, how is it that landscape can make us hopeful about all that makes us despair that we have any kind of future, sometimes at a personal level, sometimes with our companions and lovers and families, with our country, with the communities that we're a part of? All of us feel a sense of despair more than just once in a while, I think, that things are very grim, and it's not going to finally work for us as people somehow. And we all live in fear of abandonment. We all live in fear of being left alone and unloved. And I hate that. Mm-hmm. And I want to find a way as a writer to work with other men and women to create a literature of hope. And for me, again, because my metaphors are not the metaphors of urban landscapes, but the metaphors of lightly populated places, I want to go into those places and struggle to find those things that will make a person who will never be in a place like the Tanami Desert or at the South Pole or diving into the sea ice have a greater sense of hope about her life or his life.
When you're conducting research like this, do you in some ways just carry yourself to the place carrying the question? That is to say, do you stand on the ice in Antarctica, mm-hmm. or float under the ice, mm-hmm. in Antarctica, or wherever you are, holding this question of hope to see what comes?
Sort of, but what I find is that many of the questions that I bring with me are foolish because they were made up somewhere else.
Huh.
And it's the same, I often liken this to being to what happens when you meet someone. If you're going to talk with someone over the phone and you then you're going to meet and you're going to go to a movie or something and they're a new friend and you're thinking, oh, well, I wonder if they do this or I wonder if they do that. When you meet them, you think, oh, you know, that question has nothing to do with this person's life. But now that I've just met this person, this is really interesting. I'd like to talk to them about that. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same with a landscape. I go to a place, I've done reading, that kind of research in the library before I go to a foreign place. I've tried to prepare myself a little out of respect for the place. And when I arrive, I see that some of my questions are poorly thought out, some of them are irrelevant, some of the questions that I thought were stupid to begin with turn out to be good ones. Mm-hmm. But if I'm really doing my work well, I'll feel confident enough to make myself completely vulnerable to the place, and in that way create a context in which what I would call a dimension or a kind of love, excuse me, can take place.
What do you mean by vulnerability to
just
a place?
Just to be open to it, to say, uh-huh. If I would just be quiet, would you talk to me? To put yourself at risk with the place, as the way you would with a person, instead of trying to overwhelm a person with how good or good-looking or intelligent or whatever it is that you are, you would just
be there
and be unguarded. And I would say that's a lesson that I learned as a child, that if you give in to the place will give in to you. And it's often true with people. If you will just give in to a person instead of judging a person, then you'll find some of the creation, if you will, some of the mystery and the power of creation is alive in that person. And if that person trusts you, then that person will begin to open up, and then you will open up a little more. And through this exchange of trust and expression of vulnerability and giving of trust, you build a relationship. And it's the same with the landscape. So I go with this question of hope in the back of my mind, but I don't ask it very often because I don't know what it's about. It's what the book is about. You know, I just see myself as this small person with his big bag of questions, dragging it around with the rest of my baggage in and out of airplanes and out in the bush, mm-hmm. and wondering if I'm going to be able to do anything intelligent and if I'm going to slow people down because I don't know the right things to do, or, you know, how much Swahili do I know, and am I going to be able to get out of this village of Lodwar in Kenya and get into a bus, and what am I going to do about this, you know, I did get malaria, and what am I going to do about that? You know, all those questions just, but that's not the real stuff. Right. You know, the real stuff is going on. I believe sometimes, you know, at the end of a day, I make a long set of notes, and I don't exclude anything, because often what you least suspect is going to be useful turns out to be the key to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And the things that you thought were just exactly what you needed to know turn out to be, not all that interesting.
Once again, this is Barry Lopez, born in Portchester, New York, lived quite a while in California and then in New York again as a child. He makes his home now in Finn Rock, Oregon, a place I heard the other day has no post office. It's getting smaller all the time.
We did have one once, but we don't anymore.
Barry Lopez, our guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Have you chosen tell me if this is a silly question. Do you feel you have chosen the places you have gone to and are going to as part of the research of this book, or have they chosen you?
I think it's both, in the sense that I felt drawn to places for no reason at all that have now become part of the book. Mm-hmm. After I first started going to those places, I realized that this was turning into a book and I needed to think about what other places would serve the structure, and then I added a couple of more places. Mm-hmm. I think the most difficult part of a nonfiction book, a book like Arctic Dreams, for example, is discovering a structure that will hold the material beautifully. And that takes a long time. I mean, you can interview a lot of people and read a lot of books, go to a lot of places and ask a lot of questions. But in the end, you have to put it together in an interesting way. And that's the hard part. Not hard in that it takes weeks and weeks and weeks and days and scratching your head and whatnot. I mean, most of it could come in a couple of hours. But in my experience, you get it a little bit here, a little bit there. You start to piece it together. You have a rough idea of what you're doing. And then you get more, a greater sense of the detail in the structure. Mm-hmm. And getting the final detail, to me, is writing the manuscript. I try, in the beginning of a big project, not to have an outline, because I think what an outline would do early on is keep you from seeing things that are good for you to see. You'd start out with too much of your own ignorance in forming the structure, instead of learning the place and letting the place help you understand what it is that you're after.
So this is, the writing is a gathering and immersion process.
Yeah.
Gather, immerse.
Right, and part of the terror of it is knowing the amount of information that you deal with is too much for any human being to keep track of, but you don't know what you need and what you don't need, so you can't throw any of it away. So you just have to live mm-hmm. with the apprehension that you're not going to be able to control all this material, or you don't know where it's going. Mm-hmm. Some parts of it, for me, some parts of this book are very difficult, that have to do with things I don't know anything about. When I went to Antarctica the first time, I thought to myself, well, there's no biology here and there's no anthropology, so what are you going to do, buddy?
You know? What do I write about?
I had to learn chemistry and geology and, you know, things that I'm not as, that I don't know very much about. And, you know, you and I were talking earlier, I've had to learn about classical music because I just need to know that, and I don't know anything about it. I need to apprentice myself in those areas.
You said to me that you kept running into Beethoven.
Yes.
In the last 6 years of thinking about this book.
Right.
Why Beethoven? Why is he?
I don't know. I mean, he is he's this very powerful, romantic figure. He is a genius. You are so much in awe, I think, of his work. You're afraid to express any misgivings that you might have about it. I have misgivings about the work. They are largely related to, I think, to some of Beethoven's misgivings about his own age. He wrote the Third Symphony out of regard for Napoleon, and Napoleon quickly became a figure that Beethoven wanted no part of, and so he tore up the dedication page to the score, the Eroica Symphony, the Third Symphony, and the way in which politics compromised the ideals of the French Revolution. Was something that disturbed Beethoven, and I know that's a lot of what came out of the Enlightenment disturbs me. Principally, the primacy of science, the notion that there is only one acceptable form of logic, and there is only one path to the truth, and that all other ways of knowing are suspect, or worse, ignorant. And again, as someone who spent time outside of white American culture, I find that idea it's not amusing to me, or ignorant. It's dangerous to believe that there is only one way of knowing. And much that came from the Enlightenment, including the United States of America, I mean, the Bill of Rights grows right out of a sense of the dignity of the individual and individual rights and writ of habeas corpus, all of this kind of stuff that came out of France and out of the American Revolution are things that increased the chance for a human being to lead a dignified life. But it was also part of the Enlightenment that science, that's where the ascendancy of science begins. And I think many very bright people who are not Luddites, they're not people who hate progress and machinery and things like that, have profound philosophical misgivings about the authority behind the scientific voice. It is a voice largely, it's largely a male voice, and it has an investment in a kind of politics that I find quite troubling. In the same way, the Roman Catholic Church that I grew up in has an investment in politics that I find quite troubling. And, you know, I just thought of Rachel Carson, I don't know why, but, you know, this book, The Rediscovery of North America, is dedicated to the memory of Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson was an heroic person to me, a woman that I admired enormously when I read her work, and who's continued to be a person I, in some sense, I would like to live up to. Because it was almost solely because she was a woman that she was denigrated by other scientists when she said, we ought to think this stuff about pesticides out a little bit more carefully than we have. We need better research to see what kinds of side effects these pesticides will have in society, not just on a physiological basis, but on a psychological and an emotional basis. She was a hero in every sense of the word. And if she'd been a man, it would have been very different for her. But she was a woman. So mm-hmm. So people, the authoritarian male voice of science tried to destroy her. And to me, this isn't an issue of gender. This is an issue of justice. And it's unjust.
And this becomes a battle for, I'm thinking, as you're talking about what I read in this book that's not yet written, that you're telling me about. This is a battle for the life of the spirit, then.
Yeah, some way. I mean, that's pretty grandiose. I don't know if I can do that, but that's what I'm, you know, that's what I'm trying. I'm just I guess there's some thread of anger in me. Mm-hmm. I've seen too many good human beings compromised in their lives because they didn't fit a mainstream way of thinking. And this is barbaric to me, to destroy human beings or to harm them because they don't fit into an approved pattern. I'm not talking about immorality and sanctioning murder and child molestation and things like this. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something as simple as I said before, as finding ways in our society to support a young black man who has aspirations outside the ghettos, which white people said, it's okay if you play in here, but you can't come outside. Or for the young woman who's 15 years old, who is defined by her classmates as not a good-looking woman or not somebody you'd want to date or something like that. Mm-hmm. Society should have some way to protect that person so that we have the benefit of her knowledge mm-hmm. later in life, instead of saying, well, if we just throw her away. I think that these attitudes, I can clarify them for myself by talking about our attitudes toward Native people and toward landscape. So those are the two places that I work most often.
Mm-hmm. Barry Lopez is with us on Conversations today. He has worked periodically with Fairbanks composer John Luther Adams, also on projects that have been created by KUAC for public broadcasting, KUAC here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He has been involved with several projects over the years, including Make Prayers to the Raven, an older work, The Bible and the Distant Time, Grandpa Joe's Country, which kind of emerges from Make Prayers to the Raven, Life in the Bear, and others. His most recent book is The Rediscovery of North America. It began as a lecture at the University of Kentucky.
Yes.
Is a single essay, The Rediscovery of North America. And before that, Crow and Weasel, the year prior, 1990 was the year for Crow and Weasel, a fable. You'll find several of Barry Lopez's books by Scribner's and Sons. More recently, he has moved over to Knopf. Crow and Weasel came out of the now done North Point Press.
Yes, North Point doesn't exist anymore. It's bought by Farrar Straus.
A sadness. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. I have been interested in a question about your life. You write about things outside yourself, which move inside the emotions, the spirit, the human's place on the planet. Mm-hmm. All have to do as much as with inner cycles as outer cycles. The odd question is a question about fame and lack of anonymity. When Of Wolves and Men came out, Barry Lopez, who had been kind of a quiet writer on America's scene for several years, became Barry Lopez, who signified something in the American public, a more important figure. Did you have to struggle with that light and find some place to put it so you could write, or was it not a problem?
No, it was a problem, and I think it's a problem for every writer when suddenly you're, as it were, discovered. It's a problem for dancers and composers and painters, for all artists, I think. And I think it's an extremely difficult problem to solve. The trouble comes because you know in your heart that the best work comes out of your own innocence and ignorance. And if the world is very busy telling you that you represent something wonderful and you know a lot, or they would like to hear you speak, it's hard sometimes to keep straight in your own mind and heart that you are just another person, mm-hmm. that your struggle is your own struggle with your ignorance and with your moral values and trying to be a good person, trying to lead a worthy life, that you're not special. But when you're constantly singled out, it can be difficult.
Where do you finally put that?
I try to keep myself in close touch with people whom I've known for a long time, where I feel a sense of balance. Mm,
they know who this guy is.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm very difficult to get a hold of. That's another part. I mean, that in some ways is artificial, but I'm either gone working on a story or a book, or at home working. I rarely speak at universities, just once in a while, because I think that's something that I should do. It puts me back in touch with people. I don't want to lead an isolated life where I start having nothing to do with people. Then how would I know how to write well? I mean, if you didn't have any contact with people. But I'm very wary of being in public. I think it's very, it can be very dangerous for any artist or writer.
Yeah.
I also realize that being anonymous has two sides. When I was completely anonymous, I could go anywhere and no one paid any attention to what I did, and so it was very easy to do my work. Now, people know who you are and they want to talk to you about your work or something like that, and it's very difficult for you then to just get on doing what you're trying to do, because people, they would like, you know, you feel, you're very touched that people would like to speak with you and their ideas are good. But when your frame of mind is getting on with your work, it's very hard to allow yourself to be in, you don't want to really get involved with that very much. The other side of not being anonymous is that I used to have to phone people and write letters and do incredible backflips in order to just get in the front door.
Yeah.
And now sometimes it'll happen that somebody will say, oh, I know who you are, I read this book of yours, and sure, we'd like to talk to you, come on over. You know,
right.
So makes it a little easier. But
so good parts, too.
Yeah, there's sometimes.
Barry Lopez, I want to thank you for an engaging hour.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thanks
for Susan.
Coming out for us. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations Today with Barry Lopez. And I hope you'll listen in again next week. Thanks again.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Good. Okay.
Thanks. Nice.